Hello there, welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald. I'm a former Director of Public Prosecutions and a barrister practising at Matrix Chambers.
And with me, Tim Owen. I'm also a barrister at Matrix Chambers, specialising in criminal law, public law and human rights law. And our guest for this week's episode is the BBC's economics correspondent, Andy Verity. What, you may ask, is an award-winning economics correspondent doing on a podcast devoted to law and politics? The answer is that at the beginning of June, Andy's book entitled Rigged, The Incredible True Story of the Whistleblowers Jailed After Exposing the Rotten Heart of the Financial System, was published, with extracts from the book serialised in The Times the week before. Rigged is the product of some 7 years detailed investigation by Andy into the so-called LIBOR interest rate rigging scandal, addressing conduct or misconduct, allegedly, between 2006 and 2010. As a result of criminal investigations by the UK Serious Fraud Office and the US Department of Justice initiated in 2012, a total of 37 bankers were prosecuted in the USA and the UK. 19 of them were convicted, and according to Andy, all of them are innocent, victims of a serious miscarriage of justice. In the USA, that fact has been recognised, with all convictions now overturned following an important decision of the Second Circuit Court of Appeal in January 2022. The same is not true in the UK, and Andy's book provides powerful support for the developing campaign to have all the UK convictions reviewed by the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court in light of recent developments in the USA, which demonstrate, he says, fundamental flaws in the approach of the English courts to LIBOR. Rigged is not Andy's first exposure of the LIBOR scandal. He previously presented a panorama film which revealed the Bank of England's role in the LIBOR scandal. And this was followed up in 2022 with The Lowball Tapes, an investigative podcast series which exposed evidence of a cover-up of a huge fraud during the 2008 financial crisis. Andy, welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thanks for having me on.
Yes, welcome, Andy. Thanks for joining us.
Now, Andy, you're obviously a brilliant economist and have a complete understanding of the city and finance matters.
You don't have to get round me, Tim. I'm on the podcast already.
Yeah, no, I know. But my question was, why on earth didn't you go into the city and make billions working as a banker or working in a hedge fund? Why end up as, no doubt, a grossly underpaid economics journalist with the BBC?
Well, I think some criminal defence lawyers will probably sympathise, because it's not about the money, Tim. It's just not about the money. I've always thought that pursuing money for its own sake is just the most tedious thing. And I was always impressed when I was growing up, for example, by my mum, who worked as a physiotherapist and helped little kids with severe handicaps to overcome their handicaps. The parents of her kids were enormously grateful to her. And that was a meaningful job. The pay was a pittance. She was very anxious about money. Money was tight, but I never wanted to pursue money. It seems too dull.
Hmm. And was that from a very early age? From before you went to university or after or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, some of the people who pursue money hardest are those who've had real poverty. I didn't have that. I grew up in a sort of comfortable middle-class existence in Barnet. I got into journalism partly because I read all the Tintin books, and that sounded like a great way to have adventures. And I also had an uncle who was behind the Berlin Wall. He was one of the few journalists to be on the eastern side of the Iron Curtain. So he was based in East Berlin, and he had Stasi spying on him from beneath. And he was also out in Vietnam for the pullout from Vietnam, and in the Czechoslovakia when they had the uprising in 1968. And so I grew up thinking that was the most exciting thing to be a journalist. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to work for a living, and someone's going to pay me. So at least hopefully it can be something interesting. And, you know, miscarriages of justice, like, the one I'm exploring in Rigged, are in a way the best thing you can do as a journalist. I always admired people like Ludovic Kennedy, 10 Rillington Place, which resulted in the posthumous pardon of Timothy Evans, who'd been executed wrongly. When the real killer was John Christie. And this runs throughout, you know, Birmingham 6, Guildford 4, Tottenham 3, you know, Barry George. It goes on and on.
Well, Andy, certainly Rigged is a brilliant piece of work. I've read it from front to back, and the story you tell is a compelling and really extraordinary one. And I should make a declaration of interest at the beginning. Of course, you and I met just over a year ago because I've been acting for a while, advising a number of the convicted traders with a view to getting their cases back before the Court of Appeal. And I previously acted for one of them, specifically Carlo Palumbo, whose appeal failed at the end of 2019. And he too is trying to get his case back before the Court of Appeal. So with that declaration of interest, can we move on then to and start with a sort of, I won't say idiot's guide, but a basic guide to what this libel thing is. And can I begin by with this explanation? So LIBOR is an acronym which stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. And between 1998 and 2010, the definition of LIBOR was that published by the British Banking Association, which was the sort of overall controller of this rate. And the definition was, quote, the rate at which an individual contributor panel bank could borrow funds were it to do so by asking for and then accepting interbank offers in reasonable market size just prior to 11 o'clock London time. So that's the definition. Can you just fill in and explain to lay people who won't understand maybe the technicalities of it, then what this thing is, why it exists and what it does and what its implications are?
Yeah, and let me start by saying the homework is worth it. You just have to go up this little hill and then you get a spectacular view. So every morning for the last 36 years, 16 banks have answered a question very related to the definition you just gave. At what interest rate could you borrow cash at 11 a.m. in reasonable size? So, for example, a trader at Barclays like Peter Johnson, who comes up in the story, would every morning work out where he could borrow cash. And he would do that by looking at the offers in the market. So, say, Bank of China Beijing might be offering 3.43%, HSBC might be offering 3.41%. And then he'd have to answer the question, but there'd be crucially more than one offer in the market for him to choose from. And he could really answer either of them equally. It might be 3.43, it might be 3.45. Both of them are accurate, truthful answers, honest answers, genuine answers to the question, at what interest rate could you borrow cash? They take all of those answers from traders like Peter Johnson, looking at the offers in the market and estimating where their banks could borrow money, and they take an average. So 16 banks put them in, they strip out the highest, the four highest and the four lowest, and that's also crucial for reasons I expect we'll come to, and average the middle eight. And that's LIBOR, the London Interbank Offer Rate. So it's a simple average, really, not complicated. You're talking pre-GCSE maths here. It's not an infernally complex thing. It's just an average of the interest rates banks expect to pay to borrow cash that day.
I mean, it's simple, but it's very important, isn't it? And it may sound dry to those of our listeners who aren't familiar with LIBOR, but LIBOR is critical because the LIBOR rate will affect the borrowing costs in all sorts of other environments. You know, what you pay for a car loan, what you pay for a mortgage, what you pay for an overdraft. So it's very important, isn't it? Because it has such an influence and actually impacts in a serious way what people pay for money in their everyday lives. It's critical that the LIBOR rate has integrity and is trusted and is honest.
That's absolutely true. And that point has been made down the years many times. Regulators said many times that there were $350 trillion of loans linked to LIBOR. Those figures are a little bit funny, but $350 trillion, just to give you an example as an economics correspondent, that's five times world GDP. Everything, all the goods and services produced all over the world, five times as much of that. So that's why it's regarded as important. But actually, the key thing about it is its accuracy and whether or not those cash traders were putting in accurate rates or inaccurate ones. And the weird thing is, that's something that the prosecutors never explored.
Well, let's come on to that. So we've explained what LIBOR is. Can we now move on to why and in what circumstances were criminal investigations and subsequently criminal prosecutions commenced, both in the USA and the UK? And if you can just, again, just keep it as simple as we can, what was the context?
Absolutely. Well, let's keep it simple. Normally, with a crime, you have a victim and they make a complaint. And then the police investigate, the Crown Prosecution Service, an independent body, which is also crucial, reviews the evidence. And then they decide whether or not to prosecute. Didn't happen with LIBOR or Euribor. This arose out of a huge public outcry.
And sorry, Andy, before you go on, you've mentioned Euribor. Just what's Euribor?
Sorry, Euribor is the euro equivalent of LIBOR, really. So LIBOR is used for sterling dollars, 10 currencies altogether. Euribor was evolved separately as the euro interbank offered rate.
Got it.
Works by similar means. European banks estimate how much they think it will cost to borrow cash between the banks, and they take an average.
Right, sorry, carry on.
That's okay. You asked how all these prosecutions started, and I can give you an answer. It's simple, but awful. They didn't come out of any complaints from any victims. There have never been any victims produced in 9 criminal trials on both sides of the Atlantic who can testify that they lost money because of what the defendants were doing. They have never shown that. They have never shown any criminal gains. This arose out of a political...
Andy, can I just interrupt for a moment? Because
of course.
I'm just thinking this through as a prosecutor. I mean, if let's suppose one or more of these traders did put in dishonest submissions and LIBOR was impacted by that, you still wouldn't necessarily get victims coming forward, because all of those millions of people who were paying slightly more for their overdrafts or slightly more for their mortgages wouldn't know why. They wouldn't understand why, and they wouldn't be in a position to make a complaint. And that's one of the sensitivities of LIBOR, isn't it? It's a highly technical city device that's capable of impacting on people's lives in a very material way without them really understanding the mechanism. So it's not necessarily surprising that you wouldn't have victims coming forward.
I beg to differ, Ken. There are clear victims of LIBOR rigging, and it's not highly technical. It's a simple average. I just explained it to you. 16 interest rates divided by 16, strip out the bottom 4 and the top 4, you got your average. It's the same average every day. And that is clearly comprehensible to all the people who take out their loans and sign that they understand the terms and conditions. They're just understanding that their loan is on a benchmark interest rate, usually LIBOR plus 1 or plus 2%. Where I really differ from you, I can prove, because actually there are victims of one kind of LIBOR manipulation, which is called lowballing, and not of another. But in order to get to that, allow me to give you a bit of explanation. First of all, in answer to Tim's question, it arose out of a political outcry, suppressed public anger following the financial crisis that no bankers had swung for everything that happened, for the £66 billion bailout of 2008. The most that had happened to any banker, as my colleague Nick Robinson said on the news, was a man losing his knighthood. He said that in 2012, soon after regulators had fined Barclays Bank a record amount, £290 million, for manipulating LIBOR. And there was a huge public outcry. People conflated what Barclays had done with the financial crisis. Even George Osborne was saying in Parliament it was about the greed and recklessness of the banks, and conflating who was to blame for the financial crisis with who was to blame for LIBOR. That led to hearings in Parliament. That led to pressure on David Green, the Serious Fraud Office director, to reverse an earlier decision not to prosecute all this that was made by his predecessor, Richard Alderman. Now, the victims thing, well, you have to look at the arithmetic, you see. So if rates were within a range of accurate rates on offer in the market, then they were accurate. So no one can be the victim in normal circumstances of an accurate statement. It's hard to prove fraud if you can't prove something false or misleading has been stated or at least inferred. Certainly under the Fraud Act, you can't do that. But what they prosecuted this under was the common law offence of conspiracy to defraud. And the two kinds of misconduct are crucial to distinguish. On the one hand, trader requests, where they were asking for rates to be high or low within a range of accurate offers on the market, like Peter Johnson was doing, that happened before the financial crisis. And lowballing, that happened during the financial crisis, when banks falsely understated by a lot how much they'd have to pay to borrow cash. And those rates were materially inaccurate, and that form of misconduct had clear victims. In fact, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has litigation ongoing currently saying that 30 small banks thereabouts in the United States went under partly because of lowballing. And the reason for that was, if LIBOR was understated and they were collecting repayments based on LIBOR, then they were too low. They were picking up money at the higher real rate in the markets, but the rate they were able to charge their client was too little. And that was tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars.
And we're going to come on. I'm going to ask you to explain lowballing in a second. But on that point about using the common law offence of conspiracy to defraud, which is what in the UK all of the bankers who were prosecuted were charged with and convicted of in some cases. A really important point in this story is that at the time that this conduct took place, which, as I say, was between 2006 and 2010, there was no specific offence of interest rate or benchmark manipulation. That offence was subsequently created in 2012 in the Financial Services Act, Section 91, I think it was. And that, therefore, only goes to show, doesn't it, that these guys were being investigated and prosecuted under this common law offence at a time where there was no specific offence to point to.
Yeah, I mean, you lawyers are used to the idea that the common law applies retrospectively, but to a layman, it's a bit of a strange thing, that legal fiction, as it was described to me as a senior judge, that said, when a judge in late 2014, early 2015 clarifies the common law, it has ever been thus. It was always the case, apparently, that when when Mr. Justice Cook, supported by Lord Justice Nigel Davis in early 2015, decided that any commercial influence on LIBOR was against the law, was unlawful, that it had always been the case that was wrong. And they said that was self-evident, which meant, of course, that no one had to support it with evidence.
Let's come on to lowballing, Andy. I mean, there are two distinct things here. The behaviour of the traders who were put on trial, and on the one hand, on the other hand, lowballing. Who was responsible for lowballing?
Well, that was mostly dictated by banks' senior managements. But at one point, we have strong evidence that it was actually dictated by central banks and governments in October 2008. There's really powerful evidence that implicates the Bank of England in manipulating LIBOR and also the UK government. That powerful evidence was kept away from Parliament. They weren't told about it when they inquired into it in 2012. We've asked the Bank of England about this many times and the Treasury, and they've declined to comment. The Bank of England says it wasn't regulated at the time and that any claims of manipulating LIBOR were unsubstantiated. But there's really strong evidence, not just of the Bank of England, but also Banque de France, Banca d'Italia, Banco de España, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York were all involved in an effort to push LIBOR down artificially right in the eye of the crisis.
And this was because of the crisis and because of the particular economic pressures which the crisis brought. The idea was that governments thought that it would cause a crisis in confidence if the true cost of borrowing became public. And so, in essence, what we had, and you say strong evidence, I think there was overwhelming evidence that the government and the central banks were involved. What was happening was that there was massive market manipulation, manipulation of the LIBOR rate by governments and by central banks, for the reasons which I've outlined.
That's right. But the juries in the criminal trials weren't told about that. The judges kept lowballing separate from the trader requests. Now, that would have been fine if it was being clear that, you know, lowballing was innocent and trader requests weren't. But in fact, from all my researches, the opposite is the case. Trader requests were innocent and lowballing, if anything was a fraud, lowballing was a fraud because it involved misleading statements and involved genuine losses for the victims, who I just explained to you might be smaller banks, and get clear gains for the perpetrators. Those who ordered it were avoiding the nationalization of banks if they were in government or central banks, which was a big commercial motive, and senior management, when they ordered it, were avoiding bad publicity that might knock their bank's share price and hound them out of their jobs. So there were clear advantages.
Yeah, so we've got two forms of manipulation, manipulation across the entire system by central bankers and governments, and manipulation of individual rates on particular days by the traders. I mean, I should make the point as a prosecutor, although it's not very attractive not to go after the big guys and to pick on the little guys. The fact that the big guys aren't prosecuted doesn't mean that the little guys haven't committed offences and can't be properly prosecuted.
Well, just come straight in there. You say manipulation by the traders. That's the whole point. That's the whole question.
Of course,
here.
Yeah.
And it's an issue, ultimately, it was dealt with as an issue of law, and a definition was given of what the answer to the LIBOR question on any given day should be. which on the basis of developments in the US and the decision of the US court, the English courts have simply got it fundamentally wrong. There was nothing wrong with what the traders were doing. It certainly wasn't prohibited. And it was common practice, whereas lowballing, I think Andy's point is, it was of a completely different order. Is that right, Andy?
Yeah, and the scales fall from your eyes on this when you start doing the maths, which no one early on in the investigation of this misconduct seemed to do. That is that, say, a trader like Peter Johnson might look at offers in the market. Before the crisis, they were only just one or two basis points away from each other. What's a basis point? It's simply a hundredth of a percentage point. So they were within two or three basis points, two or three hundredths of a percentage point would be the difference between the offers on the market. So you go to one broker, he'd say, yeah, HSBC are offering 3.43. In other words, say, yeah, I've got Bank of China, Beijing, they're offering at 3.42 to lend you dollars over 3 months. And so Peter Johnson or Jonathan Matthew or other characters in the story responsible for making their published LIBOR statements would look at those offers in the market and determine between them. And here, I hope you don't mind me using an analogy, but it's a bit like if someone asked you to tell me the price. Well, you asked me to tell you the price of oranges. How would I do that? I'd have a look at Asda's website. I'd have a look at Morrison's. I'd have a look at Sainsbury's. They wouldn't all be in exactly the same price. They'd all be slightly differing prices, but nevertheless, all accurate answers to the question, at what price could you buy an orange? So similarly here...
But hang on, let me just break in there. I might have a little less confidence in your answer if I knew that it had been partially motivated by your own financial interest.
Absolutely. So imagine you want to do a daily survey of the price of oranges, but that's a survey of people whose business is buying and selling oranges. That's what the equivalent of is here. So clearly from the start, as soon as you set up that survey, you know that I'm a seller of oranges, Tim's a buyer of oranges, and you are trading them. You'd like them to stay the same. The seller of oranges is going to want a high quote. The buyer of oranges is going to want a low quote, and the others might want it unchanged. So there are inherent commercial interests built in from the start, and that's reflected in the methodology. So you have 16 banks. You strip out the top four and the bottom four. Why? Because then if there are any outliers taking the mickey, giving you an outrageously commercially advantageous quote, they won't be able to influence the ultimate average. And it was very difficult, actually, to influence the LIBOR fix. You just did it as a little clerical thing at the end of the day. Oh, I think, would my bank prefer oranges to be cheap or expensive? I think, oh, today we're a net buyer, so we prefer them cheap. Oh, could you put in cheap, please? That was what it was like. It was not, I know, we'll weasel someone out of a few quid. Whereas lowballing, it was way away. It was like saying, I can buy an orange for 50p when you knew damn well they'd be at least 70p.
Let's just look briefly at the way the courts dealt with this in England and then initially in the United States. The first trial was at Southwark and the judge was Mr. Justice Cook, and he ruled that the issue was, quote, not whether the rate put forward could be justified by one method or another. In other words, whether it was within a range of interest rates where cash was being offered on the market. The issue was whether the trader was, quote, seeking to defraud by procuring the submission of rates which did not reflect any genuine view on the rate, but instead represented a rate which would advantage him and his employers in the trades that he had concluded. And this case, there was an interlocutory appeal and it came in front of the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Nigel Davis presiding. And he wrote a judgment which forcibly rejected the trader's argument and forcibly agreed with Mr. Justice Cook. He said, if a panel bank makes a submission, then it is under an obligation to do so genuinely and honestly as representing its own assessment. Not to do so is potentially dishonest. And Lord Justice Davis, referring to Mr. Justice Cook, said, the judge regarded that as self-evident. So do we. That the figure could be within a range provides no answer if the figure actually submitted does not represent the genuine opinion of the person submitting that figure. And in the United States, this case, well, the first LIBOR case, came up in front of not any old district judge, but Judge Jed Rakoff, who's one of the most distinguished judges on the U.S. District bench. He was appointed by Clinton in 96. He's a liberal, a reformer. He writes regularly in the New York Review of Books on legal reform issues. He's a professor at Columbia University, an adjunct professor at Berkeley, a real liberal jurist. And he supported the position of the English court, telling the jurors in his case that the relevant issue was not the accuracy of the broker's interest rate estimate of what it would cost to borrow cash, but the intent. So again, what he was saying was, if the selection for the submission is influenced by commercial interest, it's not an honest submission.
It's worth thinking about the politics here, Ken, because we like to pretend that decisions to prosecute or decisions to create new law are uninfluenced by our desire to achieve a certain political outcome. We certainly like to think our judges are just examining the law and the evidence and not actually being swayed politically. But I have to tell you, Judge Rakoff had publicly criticized the Department of Justice for doing too little to prosecute Wall Street executives. I can cite my source for
that. He had. Yeah. He had. No, I know. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and indeed, John Thomas, the Lord Chief Justice, who presided over several appeals and prevented them from going to the Supreme Court effectively by refusing to certify that there was a point of law of public importance at issue, was very clear in his remarks on appeal, that the appeal of Tom Hayes, where I know for a fact he held out for a 14-year sentence. In that appeal, in those remarks that he made, he said it was all about being severe and sending a message. So when you sentence someone and you want to send a message, that unsettles me, because I think, well, is that about the politics, or is it about the case?
Well, a full declaration of interest at the time. I wrote a piece in the Times suggesting that if you steal a car, you get 6 months. If you steal someone's pension fund, you get a yacht.
All right. And I mean, to go back to your point about the case, let's take a good logical look at that ruling that you just quoted from Lord Justice Davis. Now, I studied philosophy. I studied logic. I didn't study law or economics. I've picked that up as I went along. And there's something to me inherently offensive to logic in these judgments, and also in the misconduct at issue. From the start, the US Department of Justice assumed a false dichotomy. So this is the equivalent of, you say, in the Killers lyric, I use this example, are we human or are we dancer? Now, of course, we can be both. Why are we assuming you can be one or the other? And in that passage you just read out, Ken, there's an inbuilt assumption, an unspoken, untested assumption, unsupported by any expert testimony or anything of the kind before the courts, that the courts have made in order to go along with a description of misconduct that the Department of Justice came up with. And that untested assumption is that you can't be both giving a genuine, accurate answer to the LIBOR question, at what interest rate could you borrow cash, and also giving one that's commercially advantageous for your bank.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is this, isn't it, Andy, that both the US and the UK prosecutors adopted the same theory of LIBOR, which was critical to the success of the prosecution. And that theory was that there was a complete prohibition as a matter of law on commercial considerations playing any part in the setting of LIBOR on any given day. And as a result of that, initially, as Ken has said, the Rakoff ruling, and here in the UK, the Court of Appeal and the trial judge's rulings, all accepted that prosecution theory. And it led, as you said, to this extraordinary situation in which any submission which was influenced by commercial considerations could not be genuine or honest. And it therefore meant, as a matter of law, that even a submission which was within the range on any given day at which you could borrow money, even if it was therefore true that you could borrow money at that rate, it would nevertheless be unlawful, according to the English courts and Judge Rakoff. And that inevitably deprived the defendants of any realistic possibility of trying to persuade a jury that what they were doing was perfectly honest and accepted market practice. Now, what's happened subsequently, as I said in introducing this, is that in January 2022, the US Court of Appeal, Second Circuit, demolished Judge Rakoff's analysis and the prosecution's analysis, allowed the appeals of two men called Connolly and Black. That decision led to the quashing of all the convictions of all the US bankers, including even those who had pleaded guilty, because as a matter of law, the US court returned a completely different answer to the LIBOR question than the one that has been given by the English courts which decision by the English courts has led to the convictions of all these individuals. I mean, that's the scandalous situation we're in, isn't it?
Yes, the law that was used, the law that was created or clarified by Mr. Justice Cook and supported and upheld by an appeal panel led by Lord Justice Nigel Davis, is very sweeping, and it effectively outlaws any commercial influence on LIBOR. And LIBOR, you have to remember, it's a compilation of commercial quotes from banks. Banks aren't, you know, charities. They do everything commercially. And it's actually the trader's duty to make sure that whatever statements they make or whatever quotes they give out are done commercially with the bank's commercial influence in mind. So therefore, the traders would argue that they were duty bound to check what was in their bank's commercial interest. But in fact, that was outlawed much later. No one said it was wrong at the time. One of the traders said to me, Colin Birmingham, who went to jail, he also happened to be a whistleblower about lowballing. And then to the Fed, he told them all that the banks were being dishonest in lowballing, which really was dishonest, only to be prosecuted for something that he would argue wasn't at all dishonest years later. That whistleblower. So he told them all about it. And nevertheless, they weren't really listening to him.
To my mind now, the situation is really an impossible one, isn't it? You've got the USA and the UK, common legal systems to a great extent, and you're dealing with international conduct, if you like. This is conduct in the USA by bankers, exactly the same conduct, behavior by people operating in this global financial world. And a situation in which these two jurisdictions have reached fundamentally different solutions is really unsustainable. And I think it's important on this point. Let me give you a couple of quotes by two distinguished judges about the need for consistency and harmonisation between the common law world. In a case called FHR European Ventures, Lord Neuberger delivered the judgment of the Supreme Court, and he reviewed the approach taken by the courts in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, the USA and Canada in that case. Before concluding, he said this: it's inevitable that inconsistencies in the common law will develop between different jurisdictions. However, it seems to us highly desirable for all those jurisdictions to learn from each other and at least to lean in favour of harmonising the development of the common law around the world. And Lord Bingham, in another case, said there must be some virtue in uniformity of outcome, whatever the diversity of approach in reaching that outcome in the common law world. And so it seems to me from your book, we have this extraordinary situation now after the decision in the US of a fundamental divide on an issue which couldn't possibly be said to justify such a different approach.
Tim, you're obviously right about that, although of course it's always possible that if this comes back to the England and Wales Court of Appeal, they'll come to the same conclusion. Andy, I just wanted to read a couple of more colourful passages from your book. In one, you refer to a 2006 call that a trader made to a broker. He was explaining to the broker how easy it was to move LIBOR. He said, "Just give the cash desk a Mars bar and they'll set it wherever you want." And then you refer to what you describe as rather more serious calls, this one in 2008, where a trader says this — these of course all being recorded: "I don't care, right? Just get me any fucking trade which pays you, basically, mate. If you keep fixes unchanged, I'll do a humongous deal with you. If you keep it as low as possible, I can do that. I'll of course support you and pay you $50,000, $100,000, whatever you want, right?" The broker says, "Right." And the trader says, "I'm a man of my word." The broker says, "I know you are. No, that's a done right. Leave it to me." In another passage, you have a broker emailing someone on a cash desk saying, "My name is X. I work on the security side. Do you have any fixings today? Roger and I generally coordinate. I sometimes trade if it suits. Otherwise, skew the LIBORs a bit." And finally, there's a quote involving Peter Johnson, where he's emailed by another man who says to him, "The big day has arrived. New York was screaming at me about an unchanged 3-month LIBOR. As always, any help would be greatly appreciated. What do you think you'll go for? 3 months. Thanks. S." And Peter Johnson replies, "I'm going 90, though 91 is what I should be posting." And S says, "I agree with you and totally understand. Remember, when I retire and write a book about this business, your name will be written in gold letters and you'll have an open invitation to my bar in the Greek islands. Hee hee. I would prefer not to be in any books, writes Peter Johnson.
Well, that ship has sailed, because not only have I written about it, but the two people on that last conversation you quoted were Stelios Kontogoulis and Peter Johnson, who were criminally prosecuted. Stelios Kontogoulis was acquitted, and Peter Johnson pleaded guilty. Now, all of the defendants have various different responses to their situations, but I've just done an exclusive interview with Peter Johnson, which will be going out on the BBC and also in the Times shortly, where he makes it perfectly clear that he didn't feel guilty. Like all the others who pleaded guilty in the States that Tim was just referring to, who've had their convictions overturned, even though they pleaded guilty, they did it as a result of what David Davis has described in Parliament as judicial coercion. And here we see the worst aspects of the American judicial system.
Well, I think one of the things that your book exposes most brilliantly, Andy, is the absolute horror of the US criminal justice system, in which prosecutors deliberately and purposefully and in the most concerted way bully people into pleading guilty by threatening them with indictments that will land them in horrendous American jails for decades. Offering them the alternative of either no time or very short time in a nice comfy prison if they plead guilty, cooperate and give evidence against others. And I don't think there's any doubt at all that that's a system which is designed to encourage, to intimidate, to terrorize at least some innocent people into pleading guilty and giving perjured evidence.
I had a chat. Yeah, absolutely, Ken. I had a chat with former SFO prosecutor who spoke to me off the record, so I won't name him. But he said the American system can be a bit like torture. He'd accompanied many people over there. And of course, no one was putting anyone on the rack or, you know, locking them in the box overnight or anything like that. But you do have this overwhelming sort of bullying incentive, a huge carrot of no jail time at all, and a giant stick of up to 30 years in an orange jumpsuit if you don't cooperate. So people cooperated. I just had a message, again, I won't name him, but one of the traders who was acquitted, who pleaded guilty, he said, look, I know a lot of people wouldn't approve of what I did because I made a false confession of guilt. And the history of this scandal is littered with false confessions. I made a false confession of guilt, he said, because I was confronted with the possibility, the likelihood even, of 12 years in jail if I went to trial. Whereas if I cooperated, I get 2 years suspended sentence. And if you're going to use a huge carrot and a huge stick like that, what's going to happen is, like the victims of torture, your victims are going to say exactly what their captor wants to hear, even if the captor's case, the captor's perception of wrongdoing, is fundamentally misconceived.
I mean, the answer to Ken's point, to the extent he was quoting from some of those email exchanges.
Oh, sorry, I hadn't got to that yet.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, the answer to that point, which is a suggestion that, well, look, this is evidence of dodgy, dishonest behaviour. But the whole point was, all of these exchanges, again, we're talking about the period 2006 to 2010, are taking place, as the US Second Circuit Court of Appeal found, at a time where the BBA, the British Bankers Association LIBOR instruction, did not prohibit a panel bank from considering the positions held by its traders when formulating the LIBOR submission. And the court said this, I'll quote from the Second Circuit Court of Appeal, although the government states that the BBA's instructions did not allow a panel bank, when submitting its honest estimate of its borrowing costs, to consider the submission's effect on the profitability of interest rate swaps or other derivatives positions held by the bank's traders, in fact, the BBA LIBOR instruction contained no such prohibition.
Well, that's right. And So I mean, we think about the fundamental wrongdoing here in a fraud case, which is supposed to be some sort of false or misleading statement. So in answer to the LIBOR question of what interest rate could you borrow cash, you give an answer, 3.43, 3.53, whatever it is. The US court said what the prosecutors had to do was to prove that that answer was false. But actually, in order to do that, they'd have had to check the offers in the market at the time to see whether the trader giving that answer to the LIBOR question was reflecting the offers in the market at the time or not. If they weren't, fine, bang them up. But if they were, sorry, you haven't got evidence against them. And the traders like Peter Johnson and others still maintain that they had never put in an inaccurate rate. Yet the courts decided it didn't matter whether it was inaccurate or not. What mattered was whether a trader had asked for it.
Yeah, so in essence, the position of the English courts is that if the submission that was put in is affected by commercial considerations, the extent to which it would advantage or disadvantage the submitting bank, the individual submitting it, that's an impermissible consideration and makes the submission improper, and that's what the court that's the position that the court will have to be dissuaded of,
yeah,
or dissuaded from, if the various convicted and defendants who pleaded guilty are to have their convictions overturned. I mean, the Second Circuit was persuaded of that. We'll wait and see whether the English Court of Appeal will be.
Yeah, and interestingly, the government did not appeal the Second Circuit decision. They could have taken it to the Supreme Court, but they've accepted it, which again underlines my point that you've got this absurd fundamental difference of approach between the two jurisdictions. One of the things that I, looking at this whole area, have found most extraordinary and most disturbing is the fact that, given the novelty of the prosecution and the absence of any precedents to guide the court's ruling, the Court of Appeal's ruling, this was par excellence a case which deserved to be looked at by the Supreme Court here in England and Wales. And none of the courts of appeal that looked at these cases certified a point of law of general public importance, which is necessary in order to take a criminal case to the Supreme Court. We have this extraordinary situation in which the Court of Appeal Criminal Division can control the docket of the Supreme Court by refusing to certify a point of law suitable for the Supreme Court. And in the civil field, that isn't possible. So you can get to the Supreme Court, who then decide whether to grant leave to appeal. And so therefore, even if there was the situation that the Court of Appeal, if they were to look at these cases again, were to regard themselves as bound by the previous decisions, they certainly should certify a point for the Supreme Court to look at.
I mean, I completely agree with you about that, Tim. And what underlines the force in what you're saying is the market sensitivity of this issue. I mean, this is extraordinarily market sensitive. It's a question of public confidence in the market. It's a calculation which, as we established at the beginning of our conversation, affects everyone who has anything to do with money or bank loans or purchasing or mortgages or any of those things. And it just seems utterly bizarre, given that sensitivity and given the lack of precedent here, that this isn't something that's been considered by the highest court.
Well, your lawyers, you're more reverent about the courts than I am. I'm just someone looking out from in. But it is supposed to be open justice, and it is supposed to be subject to public scrutiny. And in a way, what I'm trying to do here is just do that old-fashioned thing of scrutinising what the courts get up to. And sorry, I'm irreverent about what judges do. I think it seems to me that there were illogicalities in the rulings that said any commercial influence on LIBOR must be out of court, must be unlawful, partly because it was retrospective, but also because it outlawed every LIBOR submission ever made. It turns out that when the LIBOR submissions were put in, the brokers would give their offers based on just 2 or 3 or 4 percentage points above where rates were actually being offered in the market. And they do that in order that the cash traders who the money was being offered to would be able to make a bit of profit lending it on commercially within the bank. Not only that, but there's evidence in Rigged, which you can read all about, that senior bankers were involved in attempts to manipulate LIBOR for commercial reasons, as was the central banks that we've referred to, as have been governments. So a law that outlaws everything that everyone was doing every day, you have to start to question, especially when you can go to jail for putting in even accurate rates. If that's not a point of law of public importance, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
To cut the crap, it's clear that it was an instrument of public economic and financial policy during those years, the crisis years, on the part of governments and central bankers to deliberately, on an industrial scale, manipulate the LIBOR rate. And I think that's a background which the courts should have considered, and for reasons which I don't find very persuasive myself, refused to consider. Well, listen, Andy, it's been a really fascinating conversation. I'm going to give you a final advert. Rigged is a apart from anything else, it's a great read, and I do strongly recommend it to all of our listeners. Andy, thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. It is a wonderful read. I endorse everything Ken said.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this conversation, this episode of Double Jeopardy, as much as we've enjoyed recording it. If you have enjoyed it, please subscribe, please leave us a review, share the link with your friends, and do check out our back catalogue, which contains guests as interesting and diverse as Professor Kathleen Stock, Dominic Grieve, David Panic, Brenda Hale, and many, many others. Thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you again soon. Our producer is Billy Lawrence, and our social media advisor is Jess Jones.